Hello and welcome, Croeso Cynnes, to our Oriel Merthyn Book Club podcast, a relaxed conversation with our exhibiting artists on a book of their choosing which has impacted them and their work. Find your comfiest chair, sit back and join us for a burst of escapism. This week we are joined by our host Kirsten Hinks Knight and current Oriel Merthyn Gallery exhibitor Helen Booth. Helen's chosen book is A Woman in the Polar Night by Christiane Ritter. Set in 1934, the book follows the author, herself an artist, as she joins her explorer husband for the adventure of a lifetime on the Arctic island of Spitsbergen. Here she will experience what it truly means to be reliant on the land and the elements.
Well, first of all, I wanted to say congratulations, Helen, on such a beautiful show.
Well, thank you.
I wish we were allowed to go and see it, hopefully soon. And a lovely video with your daughters as well that I watched yesterday that was so lovely. I know you talked a lot about your practice in that video, so I thought we might concentrate on the book today because I find it so interesting when an artist is quite specifically inspired by a book. So I thought it'd be really interesting for us to talk about that, if that's cool.
Yep, that sounds good.
Cool. So I was wondering how you came across the book.
I was in Iceland and I was keeping a blog when I was there of the residency, when I was there for 4 weeks. And an artist from Mexico sent me a link saying, while you're there, you should read the book. So I thought, okay, I'll read the book. I mean, it was quite difficult to get it when I was in Iceland, but I did manage to get a copy of it on Kindle because it had gone out of press publication by then. I think this is the second run that it's just having at the moment. And so it was really from another artist. She recommended that I buy it and sort of jump in and see it, which is what I did.
Yeah. So that was during your residency in Iceland.
Yeah.
And you were there for 5 weeks?
I was supposed to be there for 6 weeks, but COVID hit and I only actually did 3.5 in the end, which was a shame.
Oh, right. But so one of the things I thought was really interesting about the book is she talks a lot about how her experience of the Arctic environment is changed by living in it, by existing in it every day and sort of doing battle with it. And I was wondering if you had any experience of that in your residency or?
Yeah, I did. What was quite incredible was that because COVID was actually declared a worldwide pandemic on the 11th of March, most of the Chinese tourists that were due to come into Iceland weren't able to come. And quite a lot of the tourists in Iceland are Chinese because, you know, obviously they're drawn to the sort of landscape and as we all are. And so when we actually got there, the whole of the country was actually running to about 10% capacity. So we were really quite alone a lot of the time. And it was also one of the harshest winters for around 20 years. So it was pretty spectacularly bad. And we were told on various occasions not to even go out because it was so, I mean, we went out on a couple of occasions and we were sort of blown over. And we did manage to get down to the glacier. It's always been my dream to go and see a glacier, properly see a glacier. And we had to walk through about a meter deep, the snow, and it was horrendous weather.
Wow.
And when we got to the foot of the glacier, it was the first time that I've ever cried when I saw something in the landscape. It was just phenomenal. And I think when she describes, you know, there's a fantastic line in the book where she said that they're intoxicated by the sort of vital breath of nature, and I felt that there at the same time. It was just phenomenal. I felt like I was part of nature, and I was so small but also as powerful, which was great. Now I think that's what's inspired all the work, really.
Feeling. Oh, how amazing. I went to Tromsø once for 3 days. So I have been to the Arctic.
And that's in the Arctic, isn't it, as well?
It
that's
is,
further
yeah.
up, isn't it? Because Iceland just sits just below it. So I can't actually say I've been, but I've been very, very close.
Oh, right. I didn't know that. Oh, it's amazing, though, I think, because you have these romantic ideas, don't you, before you get on the plane and, you get there and the sort of, even in a tourist situation, I think the harshness of the experience when you're used to the very mild, drizzly West Wales.
Yeah.
It's quite an epic experience, isn't it?
Yeah. That's where I want to go next. I really want to go to Lofoten Islands, right at the top of Norway. And I really want to go to Svalbard, but I think that's not going to happen because it's scary with the polar bears.
Yeah, when we went to Tromsø, we wanted, because they have the Hurtigruten that goes up the boat.
That's
that goes
right,
all
yeah.
Up
yeah.
Norway. And we were going to get on it for a day trip, but we realised if we did, we'd just be stuck for about 8 hours in the somewhere completely random. And we thought, maybe this isn't wise for a couple of Welsh fools. But it's an amazing experience, isn't it?
It's wonderful. It's the best thing.
While you were there.
Sorry?
Did you see the Northern Lights?
Yes, we did. Yeah. It's just phenomenal. Just, I mean, you can't really describe it because it's, you know, you see all the photographs and they're, have you ever seen them?
I haven't, no.
No. When you see the photographs, a lot of the photographs obviously are on quite a slow shutter speed, so they manage to sort of capture the sky as this bright, vivid green. But actually, when you actually witness them, they're not so vivid, but they're even more spectacular in a way because they play tricks with your eyes and they sort of bounce around and they're not so vivid. And I was pleasantly surprised by them. You know, I expected them to be this sort of wonderful sort of light show, but it's not like that.
No.
Well, the ones I saw weren't like that.
Yeah. The interesting thing about the book, I think, because I think she is a painter, isn't she?
Yeah, she is, yeah.
Yeah. And it... all the different light states that she experiences through that winter, it's just like a painter's sort of dream, really, isn't it? There's these, yeah. When the sun goes and it's lit up by the lights, the Northern Lights, or when the sun's just disappearing, or when they get a sort of twilight as it's going. Yeah. Did you have those experiences of interesting light?
Yeah, well, in Iceland, because the weather was so bad, you know, they were sort of covered in this strange sort of mist, and sometimes the sun managed to get through it, and that's when they were very special moments for me. I mean, we stayed in a place called Vik, which is a very black sanded beach in the southern part of the island, and we arrived about 9 o'clock at night, and when we got up in the morning we literally couldn't leave because the snow had come up to the right up to the top of the glass. We couldn't actually get out of the doors, so they had to get JCBs to come and get us out. And then all of a sudden the light's there and the whole landscape is bright blue and it's pink and it's green. And then it's just within 2 or 3 seconds, it's just become white again. It's quite a strange place. It feels like Narnia in a way. It's
yeah.
Magical.
Wow.
It's weird though, isn't it? Because it's almost like time becomes something different as well when you don't have that sort of 7 o'clock sunrise and 4 o'clock sunset. It's really odd because the sun doesn't really disappear underneath the horizon, you know, just it sort of reflects, it plays, because we're so used to the sun being right above us, aren't we? And it's quite strange going that far north and experiencing the sun in a different way. It's interesting.
Yeah. I was also wondering if, like the author, your those experiences of being there and surviving there and in that different kind of state affected your work at all, or whether it's just about the landscapes really.
No, I mean, I spent probably, of this 5 weeks that I was there, I probably spent three weeks of it absolutely petrified for my life. I mean, it's terrifying. You'd go out in a car and the wind, it was just horrific, you know. They were just, you can't see the edge of the road, you can't see where the mountains stop, all of the seas become this big blanket of white ice, so it's just this white vista, and then you get the tiny little yellow way markers that just keep you on the road, and it is absolutely terrifying. But I'm not an adrenaline junkie, as in I could jump off a bridge on a piece of elastic, but I think it did sort of stir that sort of adrenaline within me. And I think, you know, I'm a different kind of adrenaline junkie, you know, I just love nature, and seeing it in a different way, it was incredible.
I think I said yesterday, Helen, sorry, that I found the book a bit, you know, at moments claustrophobic, and listening to you talk about your experience in Iceland, did you ever get that experience?
I think when we woke up that morning and we could literally not see out of the window, that is quite claustrophobic, and you just think, But then when you actually think about how sort of people that live, you know, in igloos and things, and you know, in the right in the Arctic Circle, it is quite strange. I just think we're so spoilt in you know, with the heating and hot water and towels and just to see to have to strip yourself back to something so pure is just it just changes the perspective on life, really, I think.
And you were so sorry, when you were there, March?
Yeah, it was. I would have been there this time last year.
Yeah. And what was, because you said, you're talking about the light. And I'm assuming that's what, you know, your series, A Certain Slant of Winter Light, is that what that is based on?
Yeah, when I was talking about the mist, you know, that falls across the land.
Yeah.
When the sun came through, it was like, you know, I explained it in the film, it's a bit like watching dust particles, you know, in space and things. And yeah, the light is spectacular. Yeah, but I love Wales in the winter, you see. I don't like the, I hate the heat. I can't bear it. I love grey light. I like that lovely flat graphic quality as well. It's just spectacular in the book.
Yes, yeah. Really, it was the bit just where, talking about the darkness that set me on edge. It was...
I don't think I could do that though. I think I would I'd be terrified, I think, being stuck by myself for 2 weeks with that, you know, that terrible weather and not being able to go out. I'm surprised you didn't go mad, really.
Yeah, well, they touch upon something.
I could crawl back to my hotel.
They mentioned something, don't they? So it was during the winter when it was dark, and it was when the moon came out, and they said it was something, you know, around sort of going mad when she saw the moon. Is it that sort of, because she hadn't seen light?
Yeah, she became kind of entranced.
And she wanted to go out then or something. It was,
I think, it's interesting. She talks about the sort of compulsion to stay there and how people are overcome by this compulsion. And it's interesting because when I was thinking about, I never read the books for book club until just before we do things, because I like to have them fresh in my mind. So I was thinking about it for a long time without reading it. And I imagined it would be maybe her husband was a scientist, so, and she had to go with him or something like that. And when it turned out he was just going because he likes to, you know, spend the winter hunting, that compulsion to just try, you know, I'm off now to the Arctic for the winter. It's an incredible thing to do, isn't it? But it's quite a common compulsion, I think, the pull of the sort of those northern climates. It's a bit like mountaineers as well, I think. Like, why do we have the passion to seek out these quite desolate landscapes to
exist? It would be interesting to know, wouldn't it? If we, you know, we're pulled up north, you know, if somebody asked me, you know, which sort of compass direction I'd want to be drawn to, I would always say north, but it'd be quite interesting to know whether somebody that lived below the equator, whether they would have the same pull, whether they would have the southern pull, they'd need to go to the Antarctic. I wonder if it's just, we need to be that polar, you know? Quite strange. But it is odd, the way that he just sort of calls her and she goes. It is quite odd, isn't it? Their relationship's bizarre.
Yeah, although I understand there'd been some discussion, isn't it? They'd been writing back and forth, perhaps, for a bit. Because, I know she says something like, I finally agreed to go. So I'm assuming that, you know, he'd been asking her for a while. And how long had he been out there? Like, how many years has he been away? As I said yesterday, I'm very much drawn to the gossipy side, so...
it's terribly tantalizing though, isn't it?
Yeah, because they didn't sleep together, did they? They had their own beds and they kept separate when they were there. There was no mention of any kind of relationship, like, in that respect, was there?
That was it. Like, I mean, I don't mean to lower the tone, but it's sort of, you know, she goes there and she doesn't realize, does she, that there's going to be another gentleman there.
Because she literally is just going to go and be housewife, isn't she? She's going to cook for them and keep the house. And when I read it the first time, I think I was just bowled over by the visual sort of descriptive passages of nature. That's what got me. But then I've read it a couple of times, and I read it this week, and I've been putting lots of notes on the book. But it is quite, because I thought it was quite a feminist piece of writing when I read it the first time, because she was so brave in the end. And I was thinking it was quite empowering for women. But actually, when you read it again and you just think the expectations of her at that time, they were quite rigid. And for her to just leave her children behind and go and look after her husband, it's quite strange. It's a strange book.
Yeah. Although I suppose among the sort of proper upper classes, which I'm assuming she was, it probably wasn't that unusual to not have much to do with your own children. So perhaps not. But I thought it was really interesting because culturally, at least now, I think, like my cultural association with anything sort of wildernessy, it's always white men, really. It's my, you know, your Bear Grylls, or you always have this image. And it's only really reading this book that I really thought about it. I don't think it's intended as a feminist text, but actually just taking a woman and putting her in that environment is quite, it's almost quite shocking, really. It's just not something I've really ever come across in a cultural setting.
I mean, they were shocked, weren't they, on the boat? They were really shocked about, you know, they didn't really want to leave her, did they? They were saying, no, you can't. It's just madness that you want to do it. But she went.
Yeah.
Their response to her, actually, sorry, her husband and, I can't remember the other gentleman's name.
Carl.
Herman. Yeah, and Carl.
Yeah, who was there with them. They were quite, I mean, yes, she was obviously there as the housewife, isn't it? But also, I mean, they thought that she was strong enough to manage there by herself when they had to go off hunting, isn't it? I mean, that was quite interesting and sort of, you thought, oh, they're sort of feminist. a little bit of something there.
Yeah. I think it's quite feminist just to have that thing to read and to know about, just to be given that idea of a woman in a setting that you just hadn't even realised that you don't expect to find her in is quite a strong statement just in itself.
I mean, she's quite remarkable, isn't she, really, how she managed it. I mean, I don't think I would be able to do a year, even with modern comforts. I mean, it'd be tough.
Yeah, like mentally it would be quite draining.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating to read, because, you know, she was absolutely distraught when she got there, when she saw the place and realised where, I mean, I'm not sure what actually her expectations were.
No.
But it's, and that, yeah, that was the fascinating bit, was reading sort of her coming to terms with it and then growing to absolutely love this place. To the point where, I mean, she didn't want to leave. She didn't leave when she was supposed to. So, sorry, I'm trying to think back to your film, Helen. Have you been to Iceland twice?
Yeah. I went first time. I was to help Craig, because he was doing a big project over there with the Vikings. Yeah. And I went for 5 days, and then I got back, and then I applied to the residency, and then I went by myself for the amount of time.
What was your first impressions when you got there?
I just loved it. I just loved it. I mean, if somebody said to me, you can go and live in this hut in the middle of, you know, Iceland for a year, I'd just go now. I'd go. I wouldn't even think twice. I'd just go. And it was stupid, really, because COVID hasn't even bothered to attack Iceland. So I should have stayed where I was. I would have been fine, I think.
That was the safest place for you.
Yeah, probably.
Because that's what she said, isn't it? Is that everyone should visit the Arctic. Everyone should go out and experience that. I'm not sure I want to. I'm quite happy reading about it.
Oh, I want to. I'd love to go.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether taking a toddler... and a 6-month-old is a wise plan, but one day. I was wondering, actually, if that sense of calm she talks about, which is really about the landscape for her when she's experiencing that landscape and the sense of sort of empty-headedness and calm, I was wondering if that's something that we hope to get out of landscape painting, or, you know, I know your painting's not strictly landscape painting, but landscape painters, whether that's something they're trying to capture.
I think so. Yeah, I think you're right there. I mean, personally, that's what I try to do. Try to create something that's quite meditative, really, I suppose. And my I have a very emotional response to that landscape. And although it was quite aggressive and I was terrified, I think it left me, looking back, probably more peaceful, which is why I love it so much, I think. If that makes sense. I mean, there's an amazing bit, I've written it down actually, where she stands by the water's edge and she's by herself. I think it's chapter 7. I love chapter 7. That's when they go off and they leave her, and that's her sort of turning point in the book, isn't it, where she realizes that she can actually do it. And I think she's just managed to create that little peephole, and she's sort of pulled herself out and she's gone down to the water's edge. And I just think it's at that point when she just realizes that nature is so powerful then, and there's, you know, she's just got to resign herself to the fact that she's just got to live with it, because she can't fight it. It's just going to do what it does, even if, you know, she's going to make no difference whatsoever to how nature's behaving. If she wasn't there, it'd be doing exactly the same thing. And I think I love that part in the book when she just resigns herself to the fact that, okay, I'm this little speck and I've just got to do what I can in the space, really. That's what I loved about it.
Yeah, and do you feel like that way she experienced it and the way she writes about it has something in common with your practice as a painter?
I think she's braver than me. I don't, you know, I'd love to have met her. I mean, but I mean also, you know, it was 1938, so it's just before the Second World War as well. So I think the whole leaving all Europe behind with all that sort of worry, you know, I suppose... Sorry, I've lost the question. Now I've got myself lost in. All I can see is the landscape. Sorry.
Just wondering if you recognise any of your practice in her, the way she writes and the way she interacts with the landscape.
Because it's been translated. I think. Mm. I mean, I don't speak German, so I imagine if you speak German, I think the book might have been a little bit more, you know, a bit more melodic, maybe. I think it's quite rigid, isn't it, the way that it's been translated, but. You know, I think I've probably, and you know, to sort of judge her writing being that sort of rigid and strict might not be very fair, but I think I'd probably be a bit more softer, maybe, as an artist. Yeah. I'm a bit softer than she is, maybe.
Yeah, reading her account, isn't it, of her time up there, you know, she talks about the landscape and how magical it is, and she definitely captures that. But she also, you know, talks about at times how grim it is. And actually, the work in your show here, it's not all light and magical,
no,
is it?
No, there's definitely opposite.
I hope that's not.
No, that's true. I try to have that balance, you know. There's always, you know, wherever there's light, there has to be dark, you know. It's that sort of, you know, but I don't really put them ever together on the same. You know, I don't have that grey space. You know, it's always one or the other.
Because those, the black ones, the black tide and black ice are really, when I've seen photos of the sort of, the sand, isn't it?
Yeah.
Out there. It's mad. It's like they are harsh paintings, aren't they?
Yeah.
And I imagine that it's a harsh landscape. It's just, I think they sort of capture it amazingly well. And... they're also your graphite ones, your graphite sketches that are framed next to the
They were done. They were drawn there, and because it was -20, you know, I had to be very quick because my hands were really cold. So the drawings are sort of really quick charcoal drawings, and I quite like that. It's because there's no, you know, I wasn't able to make any corrections, and I quite like that. You know, it was like I was there, they were made there, and then that's it. They're finished. You know. I like that. Otherwise, you fanny about with stuff and you destroy it and things like that. Yeah.
Those are the ones, if this book had illustrations, those would perfectly illustrate it for me. Those are actually what I imagine when I was reading the book. And sort of then when I saw those drawings, it was like, wow, the two sort of marry together. She didn't write about... Do we know whether she did any painting out there? She definitely didn't write about it, did she?
I don't know much about her work. I think those little sketches, are they not hers in the book? I think they might be those little scratchy little sketches.
Yeah.
But I don't think she wrote again, did she? She only ever wrote that one book. So I don't really know about her. I don't, that's terrible, isn't it? But I've not really looked into her creative side, you know, into her sort of making side. I'll have to have a look.
Yeah, I know, I looked her up, but I couldn't see any more about her as an artist. And it just seems like such a shame. And
maybe she went back. You
know, said she didn't.
Or she might have, I know, she lived till she was, I think she's only recently died, 2005 or something. She was quite an old lady when she died.
Yeah, I read something that they called, they renamed the hut Ritter Hut or something. So,
oh,
I don't
really?
Know. Yeah, I read that somewhere. Whether they, whether her husband was out there forever, we don't know, do we? But it's funny though, isn't it? Because, I mean, really, it's kind of a act of folly, isn't it? There's no reason that they need to be there or go there and have that experience. They don't actually have to battle the elements and trap bears, and it's a more common idea now, isn't it? We do that, we go and have experiences, but it's not something that I think would have been particularly normal back then.
No, because if you think about it, from what you were saying, you know, she obviously came from quite a middle class, quite well-to-do family, because she left her children behind. So there was obviously no need for them to make money by trapping and by selling furs, was there? So there is, he must have just been an explorer, maybe. And he just wanted her to experience it in the same way.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because when we hear the history of explorers, they're usually really, really privileged stories we're hearing, you know, with a lot going on in the background to fund them and keep them going, like tries on Everest and stuff like that. You know, it was like the whole Second World War industry went into making that happen, that you don't see, and you just hear about one very rich white man going up a hill, you know. And it's interesting because they're somewhere in the middle, aren't they? They are doing it all themselves and having that experience, but it is through choice, you know. They haven't got to do that. Survive.
It's a bit like Shackleton, I suppose, isn't it? Because that was, you know, that was a very wealthy trip, essentially. But then all of the people, obviously, that were on the boat were just normal working men and boys, weren't they? So I suppose they were experiencing it maybe the same way that they experienced it. Not Shackleton himself, but the people that were left behind. Maybe they had to survive. It's like you were saying yesterday about the terror, Rachel, and how you can't get beyond episode 6. Too scary. But it seems weird, isn't it? It's like almost like climate change has sort of everybody's sort of psyche sort of moving towards that, isn't it? It's like we have to see the ice, we have to see the glaciers, and to try and understand it, isn't it? Put it all into perspective, which is I think why I loved going to the glacier, because I'd seen the Oliver Eliasson exhibition at the Tate and all the photographs that he'd taken from the glaciers and the sort of 20-year gap between the two. And it was quite shocking how small they were now compared to what they would have been 20 years ago. And I just felt that I needed to see it before they would be gone forever, really.
So. Yeah, it's amazing when she talks about the pack ice, I thought, and they're waiting for the pack ice to turn up, and maybe it will and maybe it won't. And just say that a landscape that shifts that radically, that suddenly is just such an alien thing to us, isn't it? I mean, we just don't get that in the less harsh parts of the world.
Yeah.
Must have just been incredible to just wake up one day and the sea is gone and there's
I know. A whole new and polar world. Bears, isn't it? And being able to come and get you then,
yeah.
I really like the eider ducks, you know, the way that the eider ducks sort of pace the time as well, wasn't it? It's like, oh, they've gone, so they're coming back. So spring's coming. I really like the use of animals in the book, and I love the stoves, how she used to describe all the stoves and how awful they were and dilapidated, and how she cooked. It's incredible.
Yeah, they just literally used the hut as an oven to make bread.
Yeah.
Just it's insane, isn't it? Not what I was expecting at all, really, from the book. That level of like bodging, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
You think if you're gonna go to the Arctic for a year in the winter, you'd be, you know, you'd get a decent stove involved. But no.
Yeah.
But doesn't he bring one back, Carl? Or is it Herman that brings a stove back from somewhere? Have I read that right? Didn't sound like they
Yeah, they'd brought a new one for a different hut, I think, hadn't they? A very, very small one, and he got that out. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that was mad to me, because, you know, installing a wood burner it's sort of, you know, it's a large scale project now. Like, I have one right here.
And it's when she's saying things like, oh, it was minus 14 and it felt so warm to us. Yeah. And you think, happy
because, I mean, when she was on her own, it was 14. Minus 35, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it was minus 20 in Iceland when we were there, and it's, that is bloody cold. But then we have all the modern tech, you know, we have the merino wool underneath. And when you think about what they would have had then, it would just literally have been wool, wouldn't it? And cottons, and there were no synthetics in 1938. So, and you know, when they used to come back and she'd spent days tidying up the house, and they used to just come in and throw all the stuff all over the place and hang up dead foxes, I'd have been fuming. Just like, for God's sake. And I loved the bit though when it's his spring and she starts a sort of nest build. And I really like that, when they were talking about how there was a sort of a natural, almost feminine need in the spring to spring clean everything and get it all tidy. And I really like that, because I think there is that in women as well. There's that sort of cyclical clock, you know, where
sort of to get that order. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm still looking for mine.
Mine's there, I just ignore it.
No, well, it must be quite easy to tidy when you live in a 10-foot square hut, mustn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Not too what much. What are you moaning about?
It was mad, wasn't it? Because she was on about, she was washing it and it was freezing. So it was like everything was ice inside the house.
And they were really angry at her for washing the floor because it was freezing.
I think that was the only argument, wasn't it, in the book as well? That she really fell out with her husband over it, didn't? Because he got very cross with her, didn't he, about it? Because he was called, he got really angry with her.
Yeah, I think that was something that didn't quite translate very well. You know, they were having words when she was refusing to leave the first time.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't written as they were having words, but he was very silent. It was sort of, he just wasn't saying anything.
Well, they don't get along really, isn't it? I know. Shut in this tiny little hut, do you think there'd be all sorts of ructions? Although perhaps she's too nice to bring them up in the book.
It's quite strange, though, isn't it? Because they don't sleep in the same bed. They sleep separately. So there's obviously none of the sort of that going on. So I suppose really she couldn't have fell pregnant when she was there, though. So they probably had to be very careful of that, because you couldn't have a baby there, really, could you? So maybe that's why they kept everything separate.
Best behaviour.
Yeah. That's the gossipy side. That's the gossipy side, Rachel. I bet you went straight to the 20-year-old.
They'd have had to kick him out, wouldn't they?
Oh dear.
No, I felt really sad when Carl, he was going back to the mainland, wouldn't he, to work for the summer, is that right? And he was staying on. I felt really sad for them. They just got each other then, basically.
Yeah. That's pretty intense, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, to go from sort of, being shocked that there was a third person staying with them for a year, and then to not have, you know, a different person's company, you know, to have that person's company is sort of, I don't know, I felt very,
One of the really nice things about it was the warmth between all the different hunters and all the people who were there. There was such warmth in their description of their brief sort of visits with each other. And it's like the environment seemed to breed such sort of easy closeness between them.
I love the Englishman that wore shorts and a t-shirt and at the beginning, and he was just like, he refused to go home because any excuse just to stay on, wasn't it? And he was mesmerized by the place. You know, you do get so intoxicated by it, and I'm not sure, I just think you just feel like you have to abandon yourself to it, because if you start try to control it or sort of make sense of it, I think you'd just go a little bit mad. You know, you have to live on your wits almost. I mean, I had to wear goggles because it was so, I burnt my eyes the first day that I was there. I had to wear snow goggles because I just didn't expect it, because I'd never been skiing or anything like that. So even just something as elemental as just seeing white all the time, it's very strange place.
I don't think it's just about the experience though. I think because when I went to Norway, we did a lot of long cross-country train journeys, and I had thought it would just be like that in Tromsø, and that once you're out the Arctic, but it was just so beautiful. Just everything you saw was so mesmerizing and beautiful, and you do these like 8-hour train journeys and you're just staring out the window. You wouldn't dream of looking at your phone or whatever, because you're just captive. Those scenes are just so incredible that you can't help but be just calmly sort of experience them in a way that you just, I don't know, I've never had that experience in other places really. Maybe, yeah, like in the Alps or something like that, but it's just something about the monochromatic and the epic of it all that you just
turn
away from, isn't there?
It's just so raw, isn't it? It's so elemental. You know, there's so few people there, really. I mean, I can't believe how lucky we were, really. I mean, COVID's been awful, but just to have it to ourselves, really. I mean, we went to stay in a hotel at the foot of this mountain that's normally full with people, and I think there was 14 guests and there's 400 rooms. So it's just incredible. You know, the roads were quiet and it's amazing. I just worry about what's going to happen next now, because I'm just desperate to go back.
Really?
I need to go back. But I don't know. I'd be curious to know though, wouldn't it, if they have the same feel for the country. You know, the people that we were talking, you know, obviously Carl had witnessed it a lot more than she had, but whether you become, quite blasé about it, or whether you're still in awe of something when it becomes... when you're there, whether you just get, it's like being in India, isn't it? I've never been, but all those colours, it'd be just like bombarded all the time. Whether you just get used to it, and whether you would just get used to that sort of landscape if you were there all the time.
I think the hunting thing might have a lot to do with that as well, because that's one of the things that quite shocked me in Norway, is the culture of hunting things and skinning them and then photographing that and putting it around the place. So, you know what, a relaxing cafe full of, you know, photographs of bloody hunting scenes, you know. But I think that's how it gets to be part of your life, is those things, that's how you're engaged with that landscape when you live there all the time, is through stuff like hunting and sports and stuff like that, which are quite shocking maybe to us to be such a big part of your culture. But I think that's one of the ways that they keep engaging with the landscape and revering it, I suppose.
Yeah, because it is quite interesting, isn't it, when she arrives, because she's so, she calls it murder, doesn't she, at the beginning, and then she gets so attached to the little fox, and it's just so, it's so worrying, you know, for her. And whether he gets away or not, I don't know, whether he was sort of knocked over the head and hidden by Carl, we never know, do we, because she goes back and comes back and he's gone. But when she starts off and she calls all that sort of hunting murder, but then by the end of it, when she actually leaves and the guy on the boat offers her a slice of seal, it's like she's almost come to understand it, hasn't she? She's sort of, you know, they are hunting for sport in terms of they want to make beautiful fox fur collars for the people back in Europe, but, you know, killing seals and things, it was a necessity, wasn't it, I suppose? So it was finding that balance as well. And on the second read, third read, it was just like, I do have a problem with the hunting side of it, but I suppose if it's for food, you can understand that, but then... for fashion, that's questionable, isn't it?
But then that's woven into the traditional ways of doing things in that place. You know, the huts wouldn't exist, the experience wouldn't exist, and the ways of going about that year that was so mesmerising to her wouldn't exist without those industries.
No, that's
right. So, yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? But, you know, I guess it's probably better than some of our mass farming enterprises.
Exactly. So what didn't you like about it? Did you like her?
I liked about her that she was quite cold, and I think there is a coldness about women that is sometimes not well explored in literature. She's quite, you know, she's like, yeah, get on with it, you know, doesn't, she's not sentimental in the slightest, is she? And I liked that about her. And she's really businesslike about it as well, like ignoring, she's like, you get a tiny bit of context at the beginning and a tiny bit of context at the end, but it's very, it's a very to the point piece of writing, isn't it? This is what I'm writing about. This is what you're going to get. There's no fluff.
Do you think the fluff got lost maybe in translation, or do you think that's just how she, I suppose that probably is how she was when you actually think about how she coped, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I think it's a different kind of female character. I know she's not a character really, but she's kind of making herself one, isn't she? A different kind of female experience that she's talking about and way of being that is quite, yeah,
quite when she gets,
yeah, especially when she gets left on her own and she's talking about her sort of process and how she copes with it, with work and sort of getting on with housework basically as a way of surviving this sort of mental torture. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Mm.
But that's what it was, isn't it? Like, at times, mental torture.
Yeah.
And it's like, I just can't.
Yeah. Like, I don't think you like the cold, Rachel.
I don't. It doesn't mean that I didn't like the book. I really enjoyed the book a lot more than I thought I was going to enjoy it. But, yeah, it did fill me at times with just so much anxiety, that's all. And it sort of brought about sort of, yeah, my own issues that I didn't really like.
Yeah, I would say it's like a book you'd want to read when you were in quite a good, in a quite a happy place. It's not something you'd want to indulge in when you were feeling down, is it? It's quite an extreme experience reading it, in a way. It's quite an intense reading experience, I think.
Yeah, because obviously, you know, she hasn't written it as a diary. So those periods of time when the men are away, I don't know how long that is. Is it days or is it weeks? And sort of, yeah, I noticed that she does skirt over that a little bit. I mean, she acknowledges that it's tough.
Yeah. It's just the experience of your husband going, oh, I'm off, maybe 2 weeks, maybe seven, you know, you'd just be like, it's such an unimaginable scenario, isn't it? And then
you do pick up on a little bit of insight into they're married, so obviously there's attachment there, but as I said, it's not a very emotional book, is it?
No.
I don't think so. But she does sort of, there's a part of the book when he is away and he gets caught in a storm, isn't it? And he comes back early, Herman does. And like she talks obviously about, you know, how worried she is, and sort of that's the first and possibly last time you get any insight into them as a couple, and obviously her being worried for her husband. It's sort of,
isn't it, like you say, because it's so structured, you know, it's quite cold the way it's written, but then some of the words that she uses to describe the landscape around her, they are so beautiful, and they're so, you know, she's so connected. There is obviously a softness there, but maybe not in the way that she's quite matter of fact, isn't she, with the way that she describes her time there. But obviously she's got something a little bit more, she's got obviously got a bit more warmth than we're being given by the book. But I think maybe it might be in translation, I don't know. It might have lost a bit.
I also just wonder if being in very harsh environments and cold places does make you a bit more matter of fact and a bit less sort of fluffy, whether that's a cultural kind of that the more north you get, the slightly brusquer the outlook. I don't know. It seems a bit like that to me. I think it gives the book such vision, though. It's a lovely piece of writing, I think. And I like that it's, you know, it's very focused on describing one particular thing, and it does it very well, I think. But I don't like it when the fox gets it. I can live with that. I didn't like that bit.
Did he get it though? I don't know whether he did, because we don't really know, do we? Because she,
I think it didn't, and I felt a bit cheated. I was like, I've invested in this thing that's gonna happen, and now it's not happened, and oh, you've got me on a roller coaster here.
Yeah, because she describes the trap, doesn't she?
Yeah, she describes the trap, and she sees something fluttering in the wind, doesn't she? She thinks he's alive, and then she thinks he's dead, and then when she gets there, he's actually alive. So she releases him from the trap and goes back, doesn't she, to get something for him to eat? And then by the time she's gone back, the men are there, and then the fox isn't there. And then Carl tells her that the fox is gone, and I'm just wondering, actually, did he, just get rid of the fox? I don't know. We don't know, do we?
Because he tells her that the coat wasn't very good anyway, which I was like,
But there is that bit the night before, isn't it, when she goes for a walk with the fox and the fox looks at her and she says he sees her true face and he runs off. And you're like, yes, stay away from the humans, everyone. Yeah.
That was great. Thank you very much, Alan.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Diolch yn fawr iawn am gwrando. Helen's solo exhibition, Breathe, is now available to view online via the link in this podcast. Find out about other events and exhibitions we have coming up, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.